So we did most of chapter two. Now, you have to keep in mind, again, that the song is about the bride. Jesus is the groom. The Shulamite bride is the church. And, you know, it's kind of a spiritual journey that the bride goes through. And she meets him. She's excited. She's comfortable. But last time in chapter two, he comes and says, come with me and let's go out of the stuff because the harvest is coming. Let's go out in the fields. The turtle doves are singing, which is a sign of the harvest. And we went through all that, and we're not going to summarize all of it. But she doesn't want to go because she's happy in her comfort zone. So, you know, most people are happy in their comfort zone. You know, in this time in our history, I mean, we live in the most exciting time ever. But at this time in our history, most people just want to stay in their comfort zone. And the church is being persecuted all over the world, and there's Christians dying all over the world. We just want to watch TV and relax. You know, we have a runny nose, so we don't want to do anything. And this is not a time for that. The time of being in the comfort zone and just doing the church stuff is over with. We don't have that kind of time anymore. There's people being killed in Nigeria every day, people being killed in Egypt every day, people being killed in Syria every day. And there's more and more Christians are showing up in Lebanon saying that there's Christians in Syria that are being slaughtered. And it's going on and going on. And here, you know, well, I don't think I'll go to church today because I'm tired and I need to be, ugh, makes me want to throw up. Makes me want to throw up. I can't stand that. And what are you going to do when the real persecution comes? You know, and it's like, you know, when you're afraid to say something because you don't want to hurt somebody's feelings, or you don't want somebody to think you're a kook, so you don't want to say anything to the guy at work or your neighbor or somebody down the street because, oh, I don't want them to think I'm crazy. What are you going to do when the guy with the machine gun comes and says, what did you say? Nothing really. I used to go to the church, but, you know, I don't do that anymore. You know, how are you going to stand the persecution? It's coming fast, and you got to be ready. You got to be ready. But anyway, the bride's in the comfort zone. She's in her house and doesn't want to leave the house. Now, the groom built the house. Remember that cedar and fir and all this beautiful stuff. And now she's decided he can go and do his stuff. He's going to stay. She's going to stay in the comfort zone. So that's what happens when we get to this, where we left off. So we're going to start in chapter 2, verse 14. Because now this is the same chapter, but now we're going to start, let's see, at 14. You can see that this is the groom talking. So go ahead, somebody read 14.
You are like a dove that hides in the crevice of a rock. Let me see your lovely face and hear your enchanting voice.
That's all you got in your verse? Anyway, so now, remember, she hasn't done anything yet. And when he told her to come out and do stuff with him, she didn't want to go. She said, oh, you go leap on the mountains. I'm just going to hang here. You know, you go do all the stuff. I'm just going to be here relaxing in my house. And I just got a new TV set and got all this stuff. So now he doesn't object to her refusal to go. He wants her to come and do the harvest with him. He wants us to come and do the harvest with him. Harvest is now. The fields are white. The fields are getting bigger every day. There's less and less people interested in the harvest.
Less and less and less.
And just because the guy's sitting next to you in the pew at the church doesn't mean he's ready for harvesting. He may just be sitting there. There's a big falling away that's gone on. Look how many less people are going to the renewal than there used to be. Now, some of these prayer groups are down to 3-4 people. And so it's getting a smaller, smaller. It's going to be a remnant and a smaller remnant. That's good because God always uses remnants. But anyway, now he calls her a dove again. I remember a dove doesn't have peripheral vision. double can only look forward, and a double, of course, is a sign of purity and loyalty. So even though she hasn't done anything, and even though he knows that she's at heart rebellious and is dark, remember, she even says, I'm dark like the tents of Kedar, he calls her a dove. Before he said, you're like the lily, you're like the rose of Sharon. Now he says, you know, you're a dove. Because she has a willing heart. She wants to be with him, but she can't quite do it. What God wants is our willingness to do something. We don't have to do it perfectly. We don't have to succeed all the time. But he wants us to be willing to do it. He wants us to be available to do it. And, you know, he gets talks about the rock. Now, where have we heard the stuff about the crevice of the rock, the cleft of the rock before? With Moses. Now, Jesus is the rock. You know, in the rock, there's safety. Remember Moses, God put him in the cleft of the rock and covered him so that he could see, he could catch a glimpse of the glory without dying. Just could catch a glimpse. He was safe in the rock. The rock provided water in the wilderness. And they hit the rock, the water came out. When Moses was supposed to speak to the rock, but he hit it, water came out. And in 1 Corinthians 10:4, Paul says, the rock followed the people in the wilderness. So Paul talks about the rock who is Christ. Because after all, from him comes living water. From him comes water that symbolizes the Holy Spirit. So the symbolism of that, the rock, you know, if you build your house on the rock, this is how you're ready. Say, how do you get ready? You build your house on the rock, then you can withstand anything. You build your house on shifting sand, every time there's a storm, the house falls down. Right? But you're built on the rock. You have to have a foundation. You know, going for the 57 minutes on Sunday isn't going to do it if you don't have a foundation. After a while, you're going to say, why should I go for the 57 minutes? I don't get anything out of that. Because you don't have a foundation. So he's the rock. And the clefts in the rock also you can look at as the wounds of Christ. You know, he's a rock and he's wounded. He has holes in his body, still have holes in his body. The wounds in his hands and feet and his side, he does still have. Everyone who's seen him, from biblical times and after biblical times and to modern times, he still has the wounds. And, you know, these wounds, just like Moses was protected in the cleft of the rock, you know, when you're in the wounds of Christ, you're protected. You're inside the rock and you're protected. So, the wounds save us from judgment. The wounds save us from the judgment we deserve. Right? Remember when we did Hebrews, it's like, well, if you're going to reject this great salvation, then what are you going to turn to? There's no other salvation. So in the wounds in the rock, so we can stand confidently in the rock. So that's how you're ready. That's how the only way you can face the world. I don't know. I don't know how I used to live without it before. I don't know how I would live. I wouldn't be able to live without it now for a day. So if you don't think about the cross 20 times a day, you don't get what happened. But anyway, so it talks about the voice. See, it says here. What's it say there in your thing? Yeah. So he wants us to come and talk to him. He wants to hear our voice. He wants to see our face. He wants to hear our voice. And he loves when we talk to him. And, you know, like I always say to people, and, you know, it's we like to say prayers that everybody knows. But the creator of the universe and your savior wants you to talk to him. Doesn't want you to use something you memorized when you were 5 years old. There's nothing wrong with those prayers. But you can talk to him. He wants you to talk to him. Because I love to hear your voice. And it doesn't matter what you say. You can say, Lord, I don't understand why you're doing this. I'm actually kind of mad about this. Why is this happening to me? But he wants you to talk to him. You can say, I don't understand what you're doing. He loves to hear our voice. And when we disobey and fall, we should run back to him because he's waiting to hear from us again. We're going to see it later on in the book too. So he wants, the thing is he's, you know, when you think about it, he's the groom, we're the bride. Now, if you got up in the morning and you said to your spouse, good morning, I think I'll just have some coffee now. I don't have time to eat. I have to go to work. At 9 o'clock, I have a meeting. And at 12 o'clock, I have another meeting. And probably at 4:30, I'm going to leave the... I mean, if you were reading a prepared statement, then what kind of marriage would you have? You have to communicate. And the communication's not always good. Sometimes the communication is argumentative. Sometimes it's hostile. Sometimes it's real good. But he's the groom, we're the bride. You know, he's the father, we're the children. I mean, he wants to communicate. You know, in Hebrews, remember, it said he's not ashamed to call us brethren. And Isaiah says, you know, a child is born, a son is given. You know, the child's born, but the son is given. The eternal son is given, the child is born. So he's in humanity, too, with us. So you can talk to him. He's not a distant, like Allah, that, you know, nobody knows what Allah's up to because... He loves to hear our voice. It's a communication. Then we get to the funny little thing. Somebody read 15. Now these are the brothers talking. This is not the woman or the groom.
The brothers?
Yeah. They're like miscellaneous people out in the community. Go ahead. In the church rather.
Catch up the foxes, the little foxes, that damage the vineyards, for our vineyards are in bloom.
So foxes. Foxes are small. They're very clever. Right? They're cunning. They're very smart. And they almost like plan what they're doing. They're a pretty smart animal. They're in a dog family. And they can destroy a vineyard at night. Now, the vineyard is her relationship. It's her spiritual development. It's everybody's spiritual development. So the foxes represent little compromises that happen or misuse of your time, misuse of your gifts. You know, so your relationship with God, which are the vines, are damaged by these things. Especially at this point, she's still very immature. If you're very mature spiritually, some little distraction is much less likely to take you out of focus. But if you're an immature person, she's still immature, any little distraction can break your relationship. And that happens to all of us. Right? I mean, you can be praying and, you know, you can be praying, you can be meditating, you can be doing, and all of a sudden, you know, something happens that takes you away. Or, you know, you find a letter that says, you know, you haven't paid your electric bill for 2 months, so tomorrow morning we're turning off your power. You go, oh, you forget about praying, you forget about the stuff, you got to go pay your bill. And, you know, these are all kind of things that can distract you. They're not necessarily bad things, but they distract you. And, you know, the foxes can destroy the fruitfulness we have. See, they eat the vines while they're blooming. So if they go and eat the immature grapes, you're not going to get any grapes at the end. So if you're developing, if you're about to bear fruit, all that little stuff can distract you. You know, John the Baptist said, if you don't bear fruit, the axe is going to be laid to the root of the tree, and then the tree is going to be thrown in the fire. Because you're not just here to be yourself. You're not here for you. You're here to bear fruit. And, you know, these kind of things hold us back from the relationship. So, you know, she has trouble coming out of her comfort zone because, you know, the little foxes are running around saying, oh, you know, you're okay in here. Why do you want to go out there? Little distractions. And there are many of them. Yeah. So the little foxes. So you got to watch the little distractions, the little annoyances. I'm distracted very easily. Very easily. Especially with things that happen at work. I can be witnessing to somebody in the office, and then something happens, and I go, wait a minute, I'll be right back. Then when I get back, I say, I can't do this now.
Somebody randomly.
Yeah. There's people in the church, and now the bride talks again. Somebody read 16. Actually, 16 and 17.
My lover belongs to me, and I to him. He browses among the lilies. Until the day breeze cools and the shadows lengthen, roam, my lover, like a gazelle or a young stag upon the mountains of Bethel.
Yeah, so we'll talk about this better place in a second. You know, now she states what her identity is. I'm hers, and I'm his, and he's mine. In other words, I have this relationship with him. That's my spiritual identity. I'm not going to be off doing stuff on my own. I'm with him. He's with me. He's my lover. I'm his beloved. That's what I want to do. That's the spiritual authority. And we have to look at it that way, even in struggles. Because nobody struggled more than Jesus did. Jesus suffered more than all the cumulative sufferings anybody had ever had in the whole world. And it's more, you know, it's more than the rejection, and it's more than the beatings, and it's more than the death. It's bearing, becoming the sin bearer. So even though she didn't go with him, and she didn't want to leave her comfort zone, she feels she's not been cast aside by him. She says, I'm his and he's mine. Confidence in him. Now this is the key. This is the thing, you know, this is the whole point, like, you know, you have to trust in him. You have to be, you know, because when you sin, you don't turn away and run away. You run toward the mercy, not away from the mercy. I mean, that's our natural inclination, is to say, oh, now I really messed up. And so, you know, instead of being with him, and instead of going to church, and instead of praying, and instead of doing, I better run away because now he doesn't like me anymore. But she says what he really wants is for you to come closer when you sin, so that you're covered by this grace and mercy. So even though the struggles go on, see, and then she talks about lilies. This is where she's supposed to live, with the lilies. The lily, of course, represents purity. Before it was lily, now it's lilies. So now it's with people that are like her, with people that, you know, are trying to be pure. It's a larger body of believers. It's a larger body in the church. That's where he takes care of his flocks. So now she kind of knows that this is her purpose now. Because she says it more confidently now. She said, my beloved is mine and I am his. He pastures his flocks among the lily. So she's more confident now than she was. But she still hasn't done anything yet. She still hasn't gone anywhere yet. She's still like hanging out. And the term Bethar means separation. And it's a symbolic thing here. The mountain that's called Bethar means, do you have that here? No, you don't have the word Bethar? Yeah. Yeah. What? Separation. So now, she still can't quite do it. You know, our relationship is voluntary. You know, nobody's made to do something. You know, in Isaiah in chapter 6, when he sees the vision in the temple, and he says, oh, you know, I'm a sinful person. I've seen the glory of God. I can't even deal with this. You know, God has to say, that's right, Isaiah. You're a horrible sinner, and I have pure holiness. These angels were covering their face, and they're singing, Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. You're a loser, Isaiah. He says, no. He goes, I got to send some people to do some stuff. And he says, send me. You know, David was a disaster. But David, you know, the Messiah is the son of David. Peter was a disaster, and he's Peter. So, you know, the relationship is not forced on us. But now she's basically saying, well, you know, you go do the stuff like you were doing. I'm going to hang here for a while, but I belong to you, you belong to me, but I'm going to kind of still hang out here. That's the easiest thing we can do for our relationship. I'll go for the 57 minutes. Rest of the week, I'm kind of busy. And I'm only going to go if I feel good. I'm only going to go if I don't have anything else to do. I'm only going to go if there's not a soccer game or whatever. And so now we come to the first test, which is the beginning of chapter 3. See, we're a fourth of the way through the book already. So chapter 3. Let's read, let's just read 1.
Night after night upon night again, I long for the one I love. I looked for him, but did not find him.
There's another, don't you have another line after that? Okay, he's up there. Upon my bed by night, I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. So now, he is seemingly hiding from the bride. This is a test. I'm his, he's mine. I don't want to do anything, though. But now, I'm calling him, and he's not answering me. He's kind of removed really should be in quotes, his presence. When she said, you know, she didn't want to come out of the comfort zone. She wanted to do the 57 minutes on Sunday morning, that would be fine. And so, he seemingly pulls back from her. He hasn't totally left her, of course. He never totally leaves you. Because in Hebrews 13:5 it says he will not leave us or forsake us. So, he pulls back from her. And starts to discipline her. All love has discipline. I mean, when you raise your children, if you don't discipline them, what happens? You get city public schools. Right? I mean, if there's total chaos at home and there's total chaos, and, you know, what do you have? I mean, love requires discipline. You know, it says many places in the scripture that Father disciplines his children. That's why God disciplines us. He doesn't do it to be mean. He doesn't do it so, you know, because he likes to inflict wrath on us, but it makes us stronger. It conditions us. It's like training for an event. You know, you have to deny yourself things. You have to not do things you want to do. And so this is a disciplining. And he disciplines us because he loves us so much. And sometimes we don't discern his presence. Sometimes we don't feel like he's there. And we feel like saying, oh, he's not even listening to me anymore. I keep asking him for the new Mercedes and he hasn't shown up yet. And, you know, I keep asking him for a raise and I haven't even gotten a raise yet. You know, and he's seemingly separated. Because we don't discern him. So now, you know, we have to keep in mind that this discipline is not a rejection. He's doing it to cultivate you and make you stronger. It's not a rejection. In other words, if you have a little kid at home, you discipline him not because you're rejecting him, you're disciplining him because you love him. If you didn't love him, you say, I'll do whatever you want, I don't care. That's right. You say to a kid, oh, you can go touch the stove if you want, if you feel like it. But, you know, it's not a rejection to discipline. I mean, if the kid starts to reach for something and you smack his hand, that doesn't mean you don't love him. It means you're trying to do what's good for him. You're trying to do what's right for him. Because remember, like we said last time, his banner over us is love. This is done in love. Everything is about love. Right? Everything's about love. When they ask Jesus, what's the greatest commandment? He quotes from Deuteronomy 6. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might, and so forth. And love your neighbor as yourself. On this, all the law and the prophets hang. Because everything hangs on love. And especially salvation hangs on love. So if we got what we deserved, it'd be ugly. It's not rejection. So now, she wants him, but she can't find him. But now she wants him back. And now she says, wow, you know, I want to talk to him. I can't. He's not talking to me. She's laying in the bed. She's still in the comfort zone. She's laying in the bed. I want to talk to him. I want more of him. But now she wants to find him. Now she wants to go look for him. She hasn't been obedient yet. But now she's in a new season. It's not like before where she's going to lay around and relax and, well, you go jump over the mountains if you want. You know, you can go do the harvest thing if you want. I'm just going to be here. You know, the other people in the parish can be doing all the stuff. I'm doing the 57 minutes. I don't have to do anything else. But now she's going to go look for him. She's been driven to do this. And notice now it says she's on her bed. Before it was our bed. Now she's by herself. Of course, it's their bed. It's our bed. Now it's her bed. And so this is a night season for her. It's kind of like a dark time that everybody goes through. It's the dark night of the soul. You feel like he's left you. He's not listening to you. And, you know, we, in our humanity, and because we live in time, you know, we get upset if he doesn't listen to us for 28 minutes. Oh, you know, a year or two or five, like some of the ancient saints and fathers who went through, and Old Testament characters. I mean, time, look at Abraham, how long he waited. You know, there, it's not that he's gone. He pulls back his presence a little bit, so she feels like he's not listening to her. She feels he's not with her. This is why, you know, the Bible says we have to walk by faith and not by sight. We have to know, we have to be grounded in the rock, and we have to know that he's there. We have to know that he's not going to leave us or forsake us. We have to go about knowing that as we go through life. And sometimes ugly things are going to happen. I mean, you might lose your job, you might, you know, you might have some financial problem, you got illnesses, you got family problems, you got death, but, you know, that's all part of life. But that doesn't mean he's not there with you. You know, and when he disciplines us like that, it also makes us more humble. You know, when you're if you're like a big mouth smart aleck always telling people stuff and then somebody puts you in your place in a righteous way, then you say, oh, you know, I really feel stupid now because I realize I was being a jerk. You know, it's a humbling process when you're disciplined. Like when you were in school and goofing around and a teacher called you to the front and paddled you, you kind of felt kind of stupid. And then you went and sat down and I still remember what it felt like to sit down after getting whacked. But, you know, you kind of got the lesson. If I do that again, I'm going to get whacked again. But we have to understand that this is because of love. His banner over us is love. And so it should drive us toward him, not away from him. Even when we don't sense him there, we need to go look for him again. We need to go reestablish the close, intimate contact. And he wants us, you know, notice this is at night. She's laying in the bed going, oh, I can't find him. I don't know where he is. It's a night time. It's a dark time. But whether it's night or, you know, whether it's night or day, no matter how dark it is, you have to know that he's there and you have to be willing then to go look for him. So now she finally, the first time in the whole book, starts to do something. Verse 2.
He will rise then and go about the city in the street and crossing. I will seek him whom my heart loves. I sought him, but I did not find him.
So now she obeys the command to rise up and come. She gets up out of the bed. She gets out of her house. She said, I'm going to go look for him in the city. So she starts to, she leaves her comfort zone. I got to go out and look for him. He hasn't left her, but she feels that. So she leaves her comfort zone. She goes out of her bed, out of her house, and she goes where people are. Okay? She goes where people are, where people interact and interrelate with each other. And it's a city. And there's people around. She's in a city. Christianity is not isolation. Now, you can be a hermit, and that's, you know. But in general, Christianity is an interactive community. Like Paul talks about, it's a body. Everybody can't be an eye. Everybody can't be an ear. Everybody can't be a foot. You know, it's an interactive community. You know, something you might have heard people say, there's no Lone Ranger Christians. You know, if you go someplace and say, well, I'm just going to be a Christian out here. A lot of people do that. But it's an interactive community. The church is the body. And a body has a lot of different parts, and they're all working together. It's a place where people interact and interrelate with each other. Sometimes there's fights. Sometimes there's, you know, sometimes there's disagreements. You know, it's not isolation. And there's disagreements. I mean, you can be in a prayer group and have a disagreement. You've probably seen that happen. You can be in a Bible study, have a disagreement. You can get into an argument. So, now, I remember at the, I think it was the end of chapter 1, he told her where, she said, I want to come where you feed your flocks. And he told her where he feeds your flocks, by the shepherd's tents. Now, the shepherd, of course, is the authority. In the church, the shepherds are the authority. You know, but there's a spiritual authority that you have to have proper relationship with. I mean, not everybody in the body is equal. And you may not agree. Okay, now, verse 3.
Watchmen came upon me as they made the rounds of the city. Have you seen him whom my heart loves?
Mm-hmm. Now, the watchmen stand for the leaders. They're church leaders. They're spiritual authorities. They're the shepherds that are by the tents. In the tents. They have to watch over the body. They have to watch over the group of believers. Now she's starting to recognize spiritual authority because she asks them, have you seen my beloved? I can't find him. Have you seen him? You know, she's not saying I'm going to go back to my nice house with the firs and the fir trees and the cypress and stuff. Have you seen him? And see, they've noticed that she's troubled because they come see what's going on. They approach her, and she humbles herself to ask the question. So you humble yourself to ask an authority something because you see yourself in a certain relationship with other people in the body. You know, we need mature leaders and people with spiritual maturity and people who have authority to interact with us in a way that we learn from them. So when we say, well, have you seen him? You know, you go to an authority and say, you know, I've been praying and I don't think he listens to me anymore. And they explain to you, he's listening. You know, don't worry. He hasn't deserted you. Because, you know, you may not be mature enough to understand what's going on, but the leader is mature enough to understand what's going on. It's a proper relationship. And, you know, the leaders should know how we're to seek him and how we're to approach him. And so she goes and asks the leader, have you seen him? I can't find him. You know, she doesn't go just ask somebody at the coffee shop, for example. And then when this happens, as soon as she asks this watchman / authority, then we have verse 4.
I had hardly left them when I found him whom my heart loved. I took hold of him and would not let him go, so I should bring him to the home of my mother.
Then, it says, then she finds him again. All of a sudden now she finds Jesus again. She finds the groom again. And he suddenly renews his presence in a way that she knows that he's back. You know, and he does that. You probably all have had that experience. You have a time where everything's kind of quiet. Then all of a sudden he's back and you say, wow, this is very powerful. Very powerful. He renews his presence again. Now she embraces him in a totally new way. She says, I'm not going to let you go now. Because this little disciplining thing she had, and she's going to get more later, this little disciplining thing that she had ignites a new fire in her. Where now she says, I don't want that to happen again. So I'm going to hold on to you. This was the purpose of this little season of separation, was to make her long for him again. To make her understand that being with him was more important than the comfort zone. So she wants deeper things now. And also, after we've been disciplined for a while, we also know now that discipline might come again. So we're a little more, you know, careful, a little more diligent in what we're doing. Same with a child. If he does something and you yell at him, and then he does it again, and you yell at him and give him a whack, when he thinks about doing it again, he says, well, first time I got yelled at, second time I got yelled at, and I got a whack, so maybe I better not do it. You know, it makes you more careful and more diligent. So she now is in a new situation, a new depth of obedience and humility. Because now she's experienced time without him. And she didn't like it. I don't like when I don't feel him. I don't like it. I don't like it even for a day, let alone a long period of time. We have to keep in mind, it's not that he's left and said, well, I'm done with her, and then at some point later says, oh, okay, I guess I'll go back now. It's always there, but he makes himself known. He shows us that he's there, or you feel that he's there. Or you see things, or hear things, or feel his presence when you're praying, or reading, or, I mean, it can be anything. It doesn't have to be in church, it can be driving over 480, and all of a sudden, you can be sitting praying quietly late at night, and all of a sudden, say, wow, I haven't felt your presence for a couple of days, and I was getting a little worried. But I know you're still there. Now, the house of my mother is the church. Right? God's the father, church is the mother. Jesus is the groom, church is the bride. You know, the father is going to present to the son a bride. The son's going to present to his father the bride. And Jesus is the husband and also the father, in the sense that he's God of the church. You know, when they started this relationship, they were in his chambers. Now they're in a place with relationships to others, and he's there. In other words, within the church, that's the context. A part of our relationship with him has to be within the context of other people within the church. It's a body. It's not a solo person. Not every solo person is their own church, right? It's the church with many people in it. And you have relations with them as well as with him, capital H. So, you know, you serve with others. That's the importance of the church. You're not the only one praying and serving. You're not the only one, you know, doing the church things, and you're not the only one doing mission, and you're not the only one studying. Everybody's doing that. Okay, let's do verse 5.
Promise me, women of Jerusalem, swear by the swift deer and the gazelles that you will not interrupt our love.
Some people say it's the Holy Spirit telling the church to be careful with her. This is all different interpretations of this. But what's this gazelle and deer business? You know, gazelles and does is what the original Hebrew is, like a doe. They're easily scared and they run off. So, you know, if you have a bunch of does and a bunch of gazelles, and you go, wow, look at those gazelles, they go tearing off. So what's happening here is they don't want her to be taken off course again. The Lord doesn't want her to go off course again. So you don't stir her up, because like does and gazelles, she may run off. And other people, whether they're more immature people, whether they're people who are totally not interested in anything, may distract her and she runs off again. Because now she's in a critical state where she's really coming into the, you know, into a deeper union with him. So this doe and gazelle thing is like a matter of running off when you get scared by something. Like, I don't know how many times, I don't know if it's happened to you guys, but there's many, many times where I'm evangelizing somebody, and as soon as you start saying, well, you know, in Romans 5, where the people who have no clue what you're talking about start to turn off when you start throwing scripture verses, and they go, okay, I don't know what you're talking about, but if I hadn't said that, maybe they would have listened longer. You know, because little things can, you know, something you don't understand can scare you, and you go running off like a gazelle. Now we get into this other stuff, which probably we should have put in another lesson, but that's okay. Somebody read, 6, 7, and 8.
What is this coming up from the desert? Like a column of smoke, laden with myrrh, with frankincense, and with the perfume of every exotic dove. Ah, it is the litter of Solomon. 60 valiant men surround it, of the valiant men of Israel. All of them expert with the sword, skilled in battle, each with his sword at his side, against danger in the watches of the night.
Okay, so now, out of the wilderness, where have we heard about wilderness? Right? People in the wilderness, coming in, then they come into the land. Where else do you know about wilderness? Exactly. Jesus goes out in the wilderness, tempted by the devil, then he comes and starts his ministry, out of the wilderness. The people came out of the wilderness. The wilderness is a time of testing. It's, you know, life in a difficult place. We can look at it as life in a fallen world is a wilderness. The places where we work are wildernesses. Places where you live can be a wilderness. Hopefully your church is not a wilderness. But, you know, and there are difficult times. It's like the Israelites in the desert. There's testing. You know, sin and the flesh are always warring against us. It's a wilderness. It's not a pleasant, it's not like a Garden of Eden where you can just kind of look at all the trees and say, isn't this all beautiful? It's like there's constant struggle going on. But it's also a place where you encounter God. You know, the early, you know, you probably know a lot of the early fathers were called the desert fathers, because they would go out into the desert and just, you know, meditate and pray, and they would get a close union with the Lord, being away from everybody. And that doesn't go against what we just said. They're special people. Not everybody's supposed to do that. In fact, very, very few people are supposed to do that. But, you know, the wilderness can be a place where you find God too. The people got manna and water in the wilderness. Jesus was in the wilderness and he was hungry. He was tired. He was thirsty, but he confronted Satan. And he came out and started the ministry. You know, Jesus came from heaven, of course, originally. A son is given. The son, capital S, of course, wasn't, you know, born Christmas Eve night. He always existed. So he came from heaven into this wilderness. I mean, imagine when Jesus was growing up. I mean, imagine all the stuff he experienced. You know, the neighbors over here are arguing, and, you know, saw a guy over there running off with some other woman other than his wife, and saw some guy over here stealing from somebody else, and then he'd see somebody over here doing something really nice for somebody, and somebody over here doing some, you know, he'd have the whole human experience. And it's pretty amazing to think, like, what he went through, because he was human too, human and divine. So we can't even, it's like sometimes you think, you know, he brought himself, even though he's God and made the covenant of law, he subjected himself to the covenant. He was born of a woman, born under the law. He was circumcised. He was presented in the temple. All the, you know, you read through the Gospels, he's always in Jerusalem for the feast days. He does a lot of his really good teaching on the feast days, dies on the feast day, rises on the feast day. You know, he makes the law. You know, he gave the law to Moses, but then he subjects himself to the law while he's here. I mean, it's pretty amazing. Really pretty amazing. Like when it was Friday night and the sun was about to go down, you know, Mary probably didn't have to say, "Hey, Jesus, come on, it's almost the Sabbath. Come on, get." He was probably there, like, waiting. You know, he could have said to her, "Well, you know, I'm Lord of the Sabbath. I'm going to say that later." But he subjected himself to the Sabbath. But that would have been exciting. I mean, did she ever have to say, you know, "Come on, we're going to be late for the synagogue"? He said, "Well, I don't want to go." He was probably the first one there. Because he subjects himself to the covenant. But, you know, he came and was in this wilderness of the world. He was made ready in the wilderness. So now he's coming out of the wilderness. He's coming out of the wilderness. And there's smoke, which is the Shekinah glory. The pillars of smoke is the Shekinah. It's resurrection, it's ascension, it's triumph. You know, it's columns, the Shekinah glory that was in the wilderness. You know, he came from heaven, then he went back in total victory. You know, back to glory. He conquered the wilderness. You know, he conquered sin and death. He conquered the devil. Death is the last enemy. He conquered death. The only way he could conquer death was to be a human and to die and then to rise. You know, he couldn't have just come as God, because God can't die. So he comes as human, and I love I really like it in the creed that it says he suffered death. You know, so much better than saying, well, he died and was, no, he died. I mean, this was, if you'd have seen Jesus of Nazareth taken down from the cross, and you'd have seen his body laying there and you were walking by, you'd have said, that's a dead guy. He was dead. And the only way to conquer death was to die and to rise from it, like we're going to do soon or sometime. So he conquers death. So he goes back, you know, totally triumphant. But because of some of the things I said when he was growing up, we studied in Hebrews, we have a high priest who sympathizes with our weaknesses. So he knows weaknesses that we have, and he knows how, you know, we're going to react to certain things. And it's not a surprise to him. I mean, do you think he was surprised when some of the stuff that Peter said or some of the stuff that the other guy said? He wasn't surprised. Or when James and John said, "Hey, could we just, like, call down fire on those guys? They're not even listening to us. Could we just, like, blast them?" You know, he probably just says, "No, we're not blasting anybody right now." But he understands why they felt that way. Because he was like us in all things but sin. He had the likeness of sinful flesh, as we learned in Romans. So he understands our journey. So, you know, the myrrh that's talked about here, of course, we talked a little bit about it, represents suffering. There's going to be suffering. The frankincense, you know, is it's an incense. It's a beautiful smelling thing. It goes with, you know, the high priest goes into incense, goes into the holy place with incense. You know, when Jesus dies, you know, myrrh is a burial spice. It smells good, but it's a burial. It's an anointing. That's what they were going to go Sunday morning, because, of course, you couldn't do it on Shabbat. So you had to go Sunday morning to anoint the body. They were going with myrrh and stuff. That's what they used to anoint dead people. And symbolically, it meant, well, this dead body now is going to smell really nice because it's going to go in the presence of God someday. So, you know, to God the Father, the death was a pleasing aroma. The death of Christ is a pleasing aroma, just like the sacrifices were. And, you know, it's because of the cross, we have these relationships, and she has these relationships, and the bride, the church exists. You know, in Ephesians 5, we started out this whole thing, but where it says that, you know, we're going to be presented as a pure and spotless bride, which is going to be pretty exciting, especially since none of us are pure and spotless. And so, you know, the frankincense is the incense that rises up. It's prayers. It's prayers of the people. It's prayers of the saints. You know, all this rises up. You know, in the temple, you had the incense covering up the smell of the animals, but also it was portrayed as the smoke going up toward God. And, you know, this thing about my, all the fragrant powders of the merchant. It just didn't have merchant in it. I don't know if it was have merchant. But anyway. But, you know, Jesus sees the pearl, which is the bride, which is the church, and it costs everything for him to buy it. You know, we're bought with a price. Paul writes, we're bought with a price. I can't remember what book it's in. But we're bought with a price. There is no higher price that's ever been paid for anything, is what he paid to buy us in the sense of our redemption. You know, and the Greek and Hebrew words that are used for some of these things is the price you pay to redeem a slave. And you had, you know, we have slavery in our country. And so, for example, if you went to Virginia and you liked a guy who was a slave, you could go to his master and say, I want to buy him. And you paid the master what he wanted and say, okay, now you can be free. You know, you paid a price for his freedom. So he paid the ultimate price for our freedom. So, you know, he sees us and he's willing to pay the ultimate price to redeem us, to make us be the body, to make us be the bride, to make us be the church. That's the myrrh and the incense. And we, too, in response to that, have to understand that if he paid that price for me, I have to be willing to follow. I have to be open to follow. My little petty concerns are not what's important. It's not about me. It's about me. My redemption is about me. But I have to be overwhelmed by that and say, yes, I'll do what you want me to do. You know, if you owed some debt of, you know, $100,000, you had no way to pay it, and then somebody said, I'm going to pay the debt for you, and got you out of the trouble, the guy says, you don't have to pay me back. All you'd have to, you know, you wouldn't go up to that guy and say, hey, could you mind running across the street, get me a cup of coffee and a cookie, and can you go over there and get me, the guy said, well, wait a minute, I just gave you $100,000. But, you know, we have to be willing to serve because we've been bought with a price, a huge price. And then in 7, we have this royal procession coming. We're going to find out in the next verse that it's Solomon. We're going to do that kind of next time. But, you know, it's this royal procession coming out of the wilderness. You know, it's Jesus sitting in victory, coming out of the wilderness. He's sitting in victory because of the victory that he's won. And the bride rests with him. The bride's going to rest with him. You know, later, next couple of verses, we're going to learn the bride's going to sit in this cool couch with him, inside this chariot, you know, inside this carriage. He's won this victory. And the valiant men are security. You know, we know that we're safe if we're in the coach with Jesus. We have security all around us. And this goes back to the ancient days of, I mean, Solomon, you know, he got married 300 times, so he was used to having weddings. He couldn't even hire a photographer to take pictures. Yeah, So she gets to sit in it and with him. We get to sit with him because of what he's done. And then the ancient wedding, at ancient weddings, the bride would be brought in a procession. They bring the bride, especially if the king was getting married. Like, remember, this was written, you know, about Solomon. So, you know, if you were a woman who was going to marry the king, oh, man, you'd come in this big procession with guards all around you, and everybody would say, wow, here she comes, and this would be like a big deal. Well, you know, the bride's brought there with guards all around her. And, you know, they're the most valiant guards. You know, they're the most valiant men of Israel because we're totally secure when we're with them. It's not like some, it's not like a bunch of privates that just got drafted. These are like the best soldiers guarding. Like they would be guarding the king, they would be guarding his bride. We're being guarded. They're not hirelings. And also, you know, we're involved in, it's not just about salvation and redemption and all the good stuff. We're also involved in spiritual warfare. We got these guys guarding you. Spiritual warfare is very tough. And, you know, their swords are ready for action. They're always vigilant. You know, the guards are always vigilant. Because of spiritual warfare, there's always attacks. The attacks never stop. If we could see what was going on around us, it would be blinding. And we can't do it. You know, Satan's been around a lot longer than we have. He could take all of us in this room on, have us for lunch. So much more intelligent, so much more powerful. And he knows, he can't read our minds and he isn't everywhere, but he knows our weaknesses. He can watch us. He knows what everybody's weakness is. You know, he knows if, you know, oh, I can tempt this guy with money and power. Oh, I can tempt this guy with lust and sex. Oh, I can do this guy with, you know, whatever it is. You know, he knows how, what everybody's weaknesses are. And so it's always a battle. So these mature warriors, it says they always have their swords on their thigh. They're ready for action. They're vigilant. Okay.